The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Avner Cohen, author of two books on the Israeli nuclear program, Israel and the Bomb, and The Worst Kept Secret, Israel's Bargain with the Bomb. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. Two Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. For reasons I cannot entirely explain, I received the magazine Condé Nast Traveler, a snooty travel publication that I believe was a free gift from having bought something else. Anyway, this beautifully produced salute to elitism usually sits unread in our guest bathroom until the next month's issue comes to replace it. But I was struck by a headline on this month's issue, Egypt, Secret Pleasures of the Nile. Talk about bad timing. Anyway, Egypt is still very much in the news this week, as it has been for the past several, but not so much for its wonderful potential as an expensive tourist mecca. Instead, the photos of huge protests in Tahrir Square, flaming cars and tanks and riots, make it seem like a less than ideal vacation destination just now. I bet, in fact, that you can get a great deal on some of those Egyptian resort hotel rooms this winter. In that context, I've been thinking about the general issue of the Arab world as it exists now and has for the past several decades. In essence, the Arab world is a seriously dysfunctional place, but not for the reasons that most critics believe. While much of the current debate in newspapers and blogs and on TV seems focused on creating some sort of democratic regime in Egypt, and while excited interviews and posts highlight the heroism of the resistance to Mubarak, the real issues in Egypt, as well as in Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states, Tunisia, Libya, Morocco, Algeria, Yemen, etc., are less obvious. The challenge for America and for our close ally Israel is to read the situation accurately and not try to judge it through red, white, and blue lenses that obscure the true challenge in the region. While every Arab country is predominantly Muslim, and usually officially so, they are mostly not Islamist countries. That is, the rule of law is not Islamic law, and the people actually running the country are not Muslim imams or ayatollahs or clerics, but secular rulers. Muslims, yes, but not running things because they believe it's Allah's will that they do so according to the Quran. Basically, you can divide up the entire Arab world into non-Islamist regimes and Islamist regimes. The many non-Islamist regimes are always, and I mean always, autocratic dictatorships or monarchies with a fair dollop of corruption. Usually, they also produce rulers from a minority elite group that holds on to power through the influence of patronage and strict, often brutal, military and police control. And typically, the ruler, or at the very, very least, the party in power, has been in power for a very long time, at the very least, decades. These regimes generally put their own dangerous opposition types in prison, or they push them out of the country to attack random Western targets. Remember, Osama bin Laden is actually a Saudi prince they expelled. Now, the Islamist regimes, on the other hand, are, surprisingly, usually democratically elected, or put in power by means of a popular uprising widely supported by a majority of the people. These regimes actually seem to change rulers from time to time, not just through the death of the leader. They are definitely trying to run their countries according to Sharia, Islamic law. There are also some hybrid non-Islamist regimes that combine semi-secular dictators, kings, or sheikhs with some form of Sharia. These countries would be like Saudi Arabia or a couple of the less secular Gulf sheikhdoms. The important non-Islamist regimes in the Arab world include Egypt, Syria, Jordan, Morocco, and of course Iraq. The Islamist regimes, so far, include just Gaza and perhaps Hezbollah-controlled Lebanon. But just outside the borders of the Arab world, the non-Arab state of Iran has been Islamist since 1980, while non-Arab Afghanistan has been Islamist off and on for decades, and non-Arab Turkey, long controlled by avid, secularist, Western-oriented strongmen following the tradition of Ataturk, well, Turkey has had an elected Islamist regime for several years, too. The real problem for America is that we like democracy and believe, at least in theory, that countries have a right to elect their own governments and that those governments should represent the will of the people. You know, the old of the people, by the people, and for the people line from Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. And we have this strange belief that if only the Arabs would elect real democratic leaders, things would dramatically improve. That was George W. Bush's theory. In the Arab world, this has, well, never been true, and it isn't now. The uprisings in Tunisia and Egypt and the widespread rioting on Arab streets throughout the Arab world are not entirely surprising. When people are poor, represented by unelected dictators and kings and sheikhs, and held in check solely by coercion and the creation of fake external demons, oh no, the evil Israeli Jews are oppressing our Palestinian brothers, yell about that! They will jump on the first crack in the veneer of domination and, as we're seeing in Egypt, explode. But the unfortunate corollary is that if you were to hold real live democratic elections everywhere in the Arab world right now, well, they would elect a whole bunch of Islamists. In fact, I cannot think of a single Arab country where an Islamist would be unlikely to win a fair and supervised election. And that makes the dilemma for Americans even more acute, because we have a long and generally successful record of dealing with secular dictators and kings. For every evil Arab dictator like Saddam Hussein or Bashar Assad who hated or hates America, we can name several like Hosni Mubarak or King Abdullah of Jordan or the various Saudi Arabian kings who have been pretty reliable long-term dictators we could mostly count on as American friends. Even anti-American psychopathic secular dictators like Muammar Gaddafi are now cozying up to America. But our record of successfully dealing with Islamists? Not so good. Generally, they hate us and try to blow up American people and things, and we less successfully try to blow them up, too. So we're kind of stuck right now. And Israel is urging America to tread lightly in Egypt, a large, influential, centrally located hub country in the Arab world. Because our choice right now is between a democratically elected Islamist regime and another Arab tin pot dictator. And no matter what we say about our commitment to democracy, we probably would be better off with the dictator. Sad but true. Oh, and one other thing. This explosion in the Arab world again demonstrates definitively that the central problem in that region, that is the Middle East, is not, and never has been, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which has exactly nothing to do with the problems in Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Tunisia, etc., etc., etc. Of course, there is one alternative conception of government in the Middle East, one freely elected democracy that has a vigorous free press, a strong commitment to human rights, a relatively low level of corruption, and a vibrant economy. That country, of course, is Israel, our truest and most important ally in the entire region. On that note, our play in this morning comes from Israel and singer Meir Banai and his song Ahava Ktsara. Ma batim
זה סיפור נוסף של אהבה קצרה והשברה.
Israeli singer Meir Banai, אהבה קצרה. When we return in a few moments on To Jewish, we'll meet our guest, Avner Cohen, who has written two important books on the Israeli nuclear weapons program, including The Worst Kept Secret, Israel's Bargain with the Bomb. Learn what that bargain is when we come back on To Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft, and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. You hear a lot of people say consistency is a good thing. After all, some places have built their reputations on consistency. Well, I gotta tell you, consistency can also mean mediocrity. If you want something to be great, it has to go through an evolution. That's why at Mama's, if we find a better tomato, we'll use it. Cheese is the same way. A cow eats grain during the winter. In the spring, he's outside eating grass. What we do at Mama's is look for the best there is and go with it. All this goes to show that at Mama's, we don't strive for consistency, except that we want to consistently be the best. Come on into Mama's and find out more about our theory of pizza evolution. It's not controversial, but it's real tasty. Mama's Pizza, 4500 East Speedway in the Midway Business Park. On the east side of 22nd and Colburn, back at the Fry Shopping Center. On the north side at the southwest corner of Oracle and McGee. And on newest at Broadway and Houghton. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza!
We're delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Dr. Avner Cohen. He is a senior fellow at the Washington, D.C. office of the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies of the Monterey Institute of International Studies. He was previously a public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center. Since 2000, he's also been affiliated with the Center for International Security Studies at the University of Maryland in College Park. And, oh, by the way, on the J Street Advisory Board and an internationally recognized author. His new book is called The Worst Kept Secret, Israel's Bargain with the Bomb. Good morning.
Good morning.
So you became kind of famous, and maybe in Israel notorious, I don't know if that's the right term, for writing about the Israeli nuclear program, which is maybe the worst kept secret in the world. Tell us a little bit about how you gravitated into that and what your perspective is on it now.
Well, I came to this issue from philosophy. I did my PhD at the University of Chicago. And I finished at the early 80s. This was the age of the first anti-nuclear movement of our own time. I was young, just reaching about 30. And I recall very vividly a colleague of mine, young fellow like myself, calling me and saying, Avner, what about doing something about the philosophical aspect of nuclear deterrence? And almost without hesitation, I said yes. And the result was a number of years of putting myself into study, into effort to understand the complexities, especially at the more abstract level of the nuclear predicament. And shortly after, in particular after I came back to Israel from the U.S., I started to look at the uniqueness, at the oddities, at the paradoxes involved with the Israeli case. And initially I was very naive and very uncomfortable, like most Israelis, to start exploring and putting tough questions on this unspoken subject of a taboo dimension. But over years, I found my own voice and I found a certain comfort. And I think that the issue has to be open in Israel. I think it fits Israeli democracy. And I think it can be done in a responsible and cautious fashion. And that's what I've been trying to do in the last 20 years. First, with history, and secondly, with some questions about where we are today and how it connected with the peace process, with Israel's democracy, you know, questions of that nature.
You know, Israel adopted its policy of deliberate ambiguity as soon as it got involved with nuclear development under Ben-Gurion. Shimon Peres was heavily involved in creating that program. To talk about it openly in Israel has all kinds of stigma attached to it, doesn't it?
It's still the case, yes, indeed. I believe it's the most profound, the most sacred Israeli taboo ever. So it takes a great deal of thinking and effort how to try to do it in a way that, for example, unlike the case of Mordechai Vanunu, would not alienate myself with my fellow Israelis, with a sense of sympathy to the Israeli predicament, and yet with some criticism about this unique policy, which may have been the right attitude to do politically, maybe even morally at the time, but has become, in my view, over the years, more and more burdensome, especially when it became, as the title of my book indicates, the worst kept secret, or Israel's worst kept secret.
We will talk much more about that worst kept secret and the whole development of Israeli nuclear arms when we come back on To Jewish with Dr. Avner Cohen in just a few moments.
At Handmaker's Senior Day programs, variety and interesting activities help Barbara Sanders really enjoy her time there.
They have a lot of activities that I like to do. They have ceramics, they have painting, they have sewing. We go out to the museums and to the parks, and we also go to the casino.
Handmaker helps seniors and disabled individuals maintain their independence longer than they might otherwise. Handmaker's flexible scheduling makes the Senior Day program very convenient, and Barbara feels right at home.
The staff is very nice. They take good care of you. They'll make sure that you have everything you need.
And there are other benefits, too.
All of my grandchildren have piggy banks that I've made from here, and I have a lot of ceramics in my house now because of here.
Call Handmaker at 322-7035 for more information and a complimentary one-day pass. There are new people and new friends to meet.
They're not just friendships. You know, you actually are a part of a family.
Handmaker Senior Day Program serves all faiths, centrally located on Rosemont, just south of TMC. Call 322-7035.
Tucson Hebrew Academy is an independent school for children from kindergarten through eighth grade. It has a long-standing track record of academic excellence and an unparalleled integrated general and Judaic studies curriculum. With a variety of music and fine arts classes combined with the award-winning sports programs, THA nourishes the students in body, mind, and spirit. The atmosphere in the classroom encourages self-assured self-expression, critical thinking, and respect for diverse points of view. THA's extremely low student-teacher ratio allows its highly qualified faculty to provide instruction on the most up-to-date proven research methods in science, technology, math, and literature. THA students understand the relevance of Jewish values in a modern world, and THA sees learning as a way of life, building a strong presence in the community. THA is enrolling now. Give your child the gift of a THA education. For more information on how to enroll, call 529-3888 to enroll or to get a tour of THA. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can get CDs of past and present shows through the website or downloading us there at the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. Well, it's Valentine's Day tomorrow, a festival based on associations both pagan and Christian and Hallmark, and clearly not something we good Jews need to observe. But try telling that to your wife or significant other and see just how far it gets you. Our good friend Rabbi Joe Black has a very clever song on that silly subject.
Valentine's Day is not a Jewish holiday. That's why I didn't buy you flowers. I was thinking just of you. I know you're proud to be a Jew. It's a most confusing 24 hours. No, I can't be what I ain't, and a day named for a saint doesn't seem to be a kosher celebration. Oh, but when Purim comes, we'll nash on special heart-shaped Hamantaschen and drink Mulligan David wine for our libation. It's a Hallmark holiday, that is all that I can say. I don't know why you think it's so essential. Besides, at $80 a pop, a dozen roses ain't so high. What's the point of getting oh so sentimental? No, I didn't buy Godiva's, 'cause the increase in your dress sizes from eating chocolate makes you weep and makes you wail. So open up the bedroom door, don't make me sleep here on the floor. I'll buy perfume for you next week when it's on sale.
You know, I forgot to ask Joe what his wife Sue thought of that song. We welcome our expert on Israel, our maven, Guy Gelbart. Good morning, Guy.
Good morning, Rabbi.
There was a story at the beginning of the year, a little bit thereafter, of a Palestinian woman who died in a protest against the security fence. And they said she died because a tear gas canister had gone off or something. Somehow she was killed. Turns out, as so often when you start to look underneath the story, that's not exactly what happened. Can you fill us in a little bit?
Sure thing. At the beginning of January, Juhara Abu Rahma, a 36-year-old woman, died during a demonstration at the village of Bil'in. The demonstration was against the security fence. She was hurt and she was evacuated to a nearby hospital at Ramallah. Later on, she died. And Israel was accused by the Palestinians and by many Western media of killing her with tear gas. Apparently, as we found out in an investigation that took place and studied all the details from this tragic event, Abu Rahma did not die from tear gas. She actually died from miscare or malfunction care of the doctor at the Ramallah hospital, who injected her with an atropine medicine. Atropine medicine is a medicine usually used to treat people that are hurt by what's called nerve gas. Now, there was no reason whatsoever to suspect nerve gas. Actually, the only place that I recall that ever in the Middle East nerve gas were used was by the Iraqis.
Iraq against Marsh Arabs and then against the Kurds, right?
Exactly, right. Exactly. And this injection, well, used wrongly, actually kills you. Okay, it dries your body out.
If you don't need it, it kills you.
Exactly, because it dries your fluids out of your body, and it's not a nice thing to have. And that was the real reason why she died, tragically. But I think this case is a very important example for us to learn that in many cases, Palestinian spokesmen and later on organizations, even here in the States, that refer to themselves as human rights organizations, choose to twist the truth and to spread rumors and accuse Israel of things without really investigating what really happened, without really learning the facts. In many cases, Israel finds itself under attack on things Israel didn't do, like in this case.
Well, it's very helpful to clarify those whenever possible and to keep the reporting as accurate as possible. Thanks very much, Guy. We will talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur, Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant at the J Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi. Please forgive me.
Oh, well, you know, I'm in that business.
I've opened another restaurant.
Downtown?
Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails, 135 South 6. I got to tell you, I am so excited about it. We have created an absolutely gorgeous space where the former Barrio Grill was located. And the food, well, you know my food.
Your food is the best I've ever had. Don't tell my wife. Although she agrees. So you're creating magic food, as she calls it, downtown. What's the best way for people to make reservations to try the new place?
Just give us a call at 623-7700 or go online at downtownkitchen.com. We're serving lunch Monday through Saturday, dinner 7 days a week, happy hour, late night Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and all with prices so low, you can afford to eat here every day.
I would love to. Thanks, Janos.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So we started talking really the last couple of weeks about the institution of the Shabbos Goy, that is someone who comes in for Orthodox Jews and does some of the work necessary on the Sabbath that Jews are not permitted to do. And it's an institution that's been all over the world, and it continues in communities that are Orthodox where there are non-Jews available to do this. There's several interesting parts about this. One is you can't pay someone to do this on the Sabbath. So a lot of times the traditional way it was done was leaving money just sitting conveniently out. You know, they'd go in a Jew would open the door.
Because God forbid you should pay them before.
Can't pay them before, because then you are intentionally asking them to do the work, which is a violation of the prohibition of making people work for you on the Sabbath. I've always wondered about this as a rabbi who does a fair amount of his professional work on Friday night and Saturday morning and Saturday afternoon, the justification for saying that we're not working on Shabbat, which always, you know, when people come up to me after service, they say, well, Rabbi, is this a full-time job? What do you do between the time Friday nights, you know? The answer is, of course, but so then maybe I'm doing Shabbat as a gift? I'm not quite sure. But it's an interesting problem in Jewish law. And the question is, how do you allow this to be a functioning part? Now, for Reformed Jews, this isn't relevant. For most Conservative Jews, it's not relevant. But for many Orthodox Jews, no matter how much preparation you do in advance, there's going to be some stuff that you need somebody to do for you, whether it's turning on the heat, turning on a light. You know, now you were talking about hotel rooms. Remember keys?
Right. I was going to say, so if we bring it down to brass tacks, a really Orthodox Jew won't use a key card in a hotel because it completes a circuit. And he'll either arrange with the hotel in advance that every time he walks into the lobby, somebody will accompany him to open the door, or they'll use the alternate of an old-fashioned key, which, I mean, it might be interesting for your listeners to know what on earth is the connection between a hotel key card and lighting a fire, and why is using a hotel key card conceivably prohibited?
Right.
That's on the one hand. But on the other hand, in a different direction that we really haven't gone in yet, which is more like Musser, a wedding doesn't have to take place on Saturday night, December 25th.
Right.
There's no commandment. So, I mean, this is not using a Shabbos goy to do work that you need to do during the Shabbos. This, it seems to me, could be construed as being insensitive to the religious needs or desires or preferences of others. So it's kind of the inverse of a Shabbos goy. And I would be grateful if you could touch on that as well.
Yeah, and I think, look, my synagogue had services Friday night, December 24th, because it was Shabbat. We have one Jewish custodian who worked that night, but we have two Jewish custodians and three who are not Jewish. And one of them had to work because we were also hosting some homeless and doing some other stuff that we tend to do on Friday nights. It's a difficult decision. Now, you know, in America, many people work on Christmas. And after all, it celebrates the birth of a Jewish guy. So it's a difficult ethical problem. And I think synagogues and Jewish families do well to consider that they would not appreciate having to work on Yom Kippur just because someone decided to celebrate a wedding that night. The challenge for us is, you know, sometimes Jewish dates happen to coincide. And where that happens, there isn't much flexibility. But otherwise, I really do think that in a moral sense, in a Musar sense, as you said, an ethical sense, it's appropriate to consider other people's holidays, to be sensitive to them. And that is also a Jewish tradition. Thanks, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Miriam goes with her husband Barry to see the doctor. When they return, she goes into the study and closes the door and calls her friend Ruth. "I just came back from the doctor," says Miriam. "My Barry is not a well man." "Oy vey, what's the matter with him?" asks Ruth. "You know, I keep telling you how forgetful Barry always has been," replies Miriam. "Well, the doctor just told us Barry is now showing all the signs of Alzheimer's." "Oy, I'm so sorry to hear that," Miriam, says Ruth. "Well, there is good news," says Miriam. "It'll be a very smooth transition." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and try to remember. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Ki Tisa, the story of the golden calf. While Moses is up on Mount Sinai, carving 10 commandments in stone, or having God do it for him, the Israelites start to worry. He's not coming back. And so they persuade his brother Aaron to make them an idol of gold, a calf, that they can now call their new God. And then they throw a big party, a bacchanal, a kind of Mardi Gras in this Sinai. Joshua and Moses hear the noise from the camp below and come down the mountain. When Moses sees the cavorting and the golden idol being worshipped, he throws down the sacred stone tablets, shattering them. The music and dancing suddenly stop. It's a shocking scene. This is one of the most dramatic, and for the rabbis of the Talmud, distressing portions of the whole Torah. The problem is acute. According to the text of Torah, our people witnessed the divine power of the 10 plagues, were personally saved at the shore of the Sea of Reeds by God, received the direct revelation at Sinai, in short, experienced God more directly than any other group in history ever has. And then, almost immediately, they turn around and reject God in order to worship a cow made out of their own jewelry. No wonder the rabbis of the Talmud and Midrash call this week's events the Maaseh HaEgel, the awful story of the calf. How can a people, given such a clear set of signs and wonders, including direct revelation and verbal commands, only follow the true God for 40 days before pursuing an artificial and bovine substitute? Perhaps the answer lies not in our God, but in ourselves. We enjoy spectacle, are impressed by it, even awed by it. But as soon as it's gone, its effects linger a very short time indeed. What makes us tick as human beings, what keeps us in line, is the very dailiness of regular rules and schedules, the kinds of laws and rituals that are very much a part of practical Judaism. We need both ritual and structure. And until these are provided in a coherent way, we flounder, even disastrously so, as we did at the time of the golden calf. Without a way to connect to God regularly, without prayer services and a personal commitment to actually doing mitzvot each day, we quickly lose our ability to be holy. And instead, we chase gold, or idols, or both. The message is simply that we need more than grand ideas or sweeping spirituality. We need religion and a Jewish grounding in practice and experience, or we won't remain ethical. Without that focus, we begin to worship golden calves of every kind. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear from Avner Cohen about the Israeli nuclear weapons program and find out the benefits and the serious problems when we return on Two Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
President Obama named a top American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee official as chairman of his faith-based council, as well as a top conservative rabbi to the council, too. Susan Stern, the government affairs advisor to the JDC, will chair the president's advisory council on faith-based and neighborhood partnerships, the White House said. We're incredibly proud that Susie has been recognized by President Obama for her unparalleled leadership and lifelong devotion to repairing the world, contributing to America's future, and improving Jewish lives around the globe, Joint Distribution Committee CEO Stephen Schwager said. Another of the 12 appointees is Rabbi Julie Schoenfeld, the executive vice president of the conservative movement's Rabbinical Assembly. The advisory council is the outcome of White House-led sessions last year with an array of religious leaders, including Jewish ones. Obama sought to continue President George W. Bush's efforts to devolve community assistance to faith-based groups while reinforcing constitutional separations between church and state. A little tricky. We'll see if he manages it. In a story that only slightly strains credibility, but I swear it's true, the Catholic Church has now approved an iPhone app that helps guide worshipers through confession. The confession program has gone on sale through iTunes for $1.99, pretty cheap for absolution. Described as the perfect aid for every penitent, it offers users tips and guidelines to help them with this sacrament. Senior church officials gave it their seal of approval in what is thought to be a first for an iPhone app. The app takes users through the sacrament, in which Catholics admit wrongdoing, and allows them to keep track of their sins. It also allows them to examine their conscience based on personalized factors like age, sex, and marital status. But it is not intended to replace human, individual, traditional Catholic confession entirely. Instead, it encourages users to understand their actions and then visit their priest for absolution. It even has a checklist for what you've done wrong. Is your sin mortal or venial? And suggests approaches for correcting such errors. Wow. By the way, the Pope also recently announced that social networking is not a sin. I'm relieved, as I'm sure so many Catholics are. Well, in view of the Catholic Church's new confession app program, I'm thinking the time has definitely come for a new Jewish iPhone app, the iGuilt app. While confession and absolution are swell, they are nowhere near as effective at improving conduct as good old-fashioned Jewish mother-style guilt. Can't you just imagine the responses? What would your mother say if she knew you were doing that? Have you called your parents today? This week? In the last month? Shame on you. Or did they send you to college and graduate school just so you could be doing this? Or, of course, you did what? Oy vey. The iGuilt app will be available for $18. $17.81 will be donated to a good Jewish charity that you should already be supporting. Although America's most generous citizens gave less in 2010 than they have traditionally over the past decade, Jews remain among the top givers. In 2010, the top philanthropists in the U.S. contributed about $3.3 billion to charity, according to the Chronicle of Philanthropy, which has a list that tracks the largest gifts made by individuals each year. At least 19 of the 53 individuals and couples named on the list are Jewish. This is a stunning number since we make up less than 2% of the population and we're more than 35% of the biggest givers, including five of the top six. George Soros ranked number one, having donated $332 million last year. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg was second at $279 million. Irwin and Joan Jacobs, Eli and Edith Broad, and Leonard Blavatnik took spots four through six, with somewhere between $117 million to $120 million in donations. While Jews traditionally rank high on such lists and figure prominently among the country's elite philanthropists, this is a little bit amazing still. Jews make up more than half of the first 57 billionaires to join the Bill Gates, Warren Buffett Giving Pledge, a group of ultra-wealthy Americans who have pledged to give away more than half their assets during their lifetime. Tzedakah is important to us. This list from the Chronicle of Philanthropy, however, also offers some cause for concern for those in the Jewish nonprofit world who wring their hands, I guess our hands, about the lack of giving by Jews to Jewish causes. The Institute for Jewish and Communal Research has collected data showing that less than a quarter of all philanthropic dollars given by Jews go to Jewish causes. And at Hirbet Madras in Israel, Israeli archaeologists unveiled a newly uncovered 1,500-year-old church in the Judean hills, including an unusually well-preserved mosaic floor with images of lions, foxes, fish, and peacocks. The Byzantine church is located southwest of Jerusalem. It's been excavated over the last 2 months. It'll be visible only this week, by the way, before archaeologists cover it again with soil for its own protection from the elements and thieves. The small basilica, with an exquisitely decorated floor, was active between the 5th and 7th centuries, said the digs leader Amir Ganor of the Israel Antiquities Authority. He said the floor was one of the most beautiful mosaics uncovered in Israel in recent years. Archaeologists began digging at the site, known as Hirbet Madras, back in December. The Israeli Antiquities Authority discovered several months earlier that antiquities thieves had been plundering the ruins, which sit on an uninhabited hill not far from an Israeli farming community. Though an initial survey suggested the building was a synagogue, the excavation revealed stones carved with crosses, definitely a church. This building had been built atop another structure, which was about 500 years older, dating back to Roman times. Scholars believe that it was then inhabited by Jews. Hewn into the rock underneath the structure is a network of tunnels archaeologists believe were used by Jewish rebels fighting Roman armies in the 2nd century CE during the Bar Kokhba revolt against Rome. Stone steps lead down from the floor of the church to a small burial cave. Other scholars suggest that might have been venerated as the burial place of the prophet Zechariah. Archaeologist Ganor said the church will remain covered until funding is obtained to open it as a tourist site, and it'll be a neat one. That's the news of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Dr. Avner Cohen, a senior fellow at the Washington, D.C. office of the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies, the Monterey Institute of International Studies. That is a very long title, by the way. He was a public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, has been on the faculty at MIT, and is the author of the book The Worst Kept Secret, Israel's Bargain with the Bomb, as well as a number of other books, co-editor of The Nuclear Weapons and the Future of Humanity, The Institution of Philosophy, and author of The Nuclear Age as Moral History. His background is in philosophy, and he is approaching really what is philosophically a very interesting and challenging position. You mentioned earlier in the show to talk about the Israeli nuclear program and Israel's nuclear approach in a serious way in public. Borders on, you know, we have to be very careful about Israeli public opinion and, of course, not to be seen so much as a whistleblower, but as someone who's opening this subject for more public debate. Tell us a little bit about the Israeli response within from the government and from the public.
Well, when my book came out and when I started even the research for the book in the early 90s, I was under surveillance of some of the Israeli security establishment, especially those who are in charge of protecting and securing the nuclear project. I recall a few years even earlier when a colleague of mine and myself were sitting in the table of the head of the Jaffa Center, the late General Aharon Yariv, and people said to us, and you know, I came from Israel's establishment. I was driven to high school by, at that time, by General Ezra Weizman, who was a neighbor and a friend. So I came from Israel and, you know, very much establishment, military establishment, I would even say. And I recall Yariv and others were saying to me with kind of wonder, with kind of even fatherly care, wouldn't you be concerned about your own security, what you do? Can you get entangled with the law? And I thought then, maybe I was naive, and I still think today, that what I did was very much within the law. I did not seek, never sought any classified documents. I talked to people, many people, and they always agreed to talk to me, not all of them, but most of them. And I thought that what I did was part of civic, perhaps even patriotic service to Israel. I think it's critical for Israel to be aware about its own history. This is a history, sacred history, which touch perhaps the most sacred part of Israeli history between Shoah, Holocaust, and Tkuma, revival. And nevertheless, I was under surveillance for a while. When my book came out in 98, first in English, 2 years later in Hebrew by the Shocken Press, the security, and the book came out without the clearance of the Israeli Office of the Censor. I had to endure 50 hours of criminal investigation whether I did or did not cross the line, whether I broke the law. Ultimately, there was never indictment. I think people were convinced that there was nothing in what I did that could be considered to be violation of the law. And yet many people remained hesitant and somewhat uncomfortable about it. I must also add that in many ways, my work and perhaps a few other people as well, we have changed the limits of the Israeli discourse on this issue, and I'm glad to say that today things are much more open than what it was 20 or 25 years ago, for example, when I had this conversation with General Yariv, and when he and his colleague expressed this concern about my own safety. So things have changed, and if I did some little help to make that kind of democratic change, I feel this was a good service for the country and for Israeli democracy.
You know, recently a guy who shared our shared last name, Samuel Cohen, passed away, who was the creator of the neutron bomb.
I know, I knew him a little bit.
Yeah, it's said that actually Israel is one of the few countries in the world that actually had neutron bombs in its arsenal. Is that true?
I have no idea. Had I known, I wouldn't have talked about it.
That's but, what I figured, but I thought
I
would
ask
aware
of the rumors, but I cannot say.
I understand. When you write about it being a bargain with the bomb, and clearly there is a certain trade-off, what does Israel give up? What's the bargain?
Well, the bargain is essentially Israel has prepared, has set up the infrastructure for its insurance policy. It's a national insurance policy. You can express it in by way of reference to the two major landmarks of World War II, Auschwitz on the one hand and Hiroshima and Nagasaki on the other hand. That is to say that in order to prevent another Auschwitz, in order to prevent another Holocaust, another Shoah, Israel, in particular small Israel in the 50s, under the leadership of David Ben-Gurion, found itself in the need to create or to have access to this awesome weapon as weapons of deterrence. Of course, if Israel loses its monopoly, if the other side has it as well, like our today concern about Iran, the whole situation, the whole strategic situation could flip itself. And that's one of the reasons, not the only one, but one of the reasons why Israel, all over those years, from the 50s and 60s on to this very day, in this area, has been trying to be cautious, responsible, and quite inhibited in terms of its action. And I believe that the policy of opacity, even though I have some reservation, even major reservation towards its conduct today, is ultimately a manifestation of that sense of caution and sense of responsibility. So the bargain was essentially preparing that ultimate insurance policy for Israel, for the Jewish nation in the Middle East, to prevent Holocaust. But in return, Israel has decided to be quite different, and indeed it got approval from the United States and from others, got certain exceptional status, to be very, very cautious, not even to acknowledge to have the weapons, and that's the whole bargain.
Can you explain briefly your concept of opaque nuclear proliferation?
Well, by opacity, I refer to the phenomenon of a nation. In this case, we're talking about Israel. Israel has invented that kind of conduct. For a while, India and Pakistan followed, and even South Africa, no longer today. So a nation has those weapons, but does not openly acknowledge the possession. Israel official line from the 60s to this very day, indeed, as you hinted, Shimon Peres was the first one to use it openly in conversation with American leader, with President Kennedy, and the line was that Israel will not be the first to introduce nuclear weapons to the region. The line has passed certain transformations over the years. But essentially that formula, that second formula, is still being used today. So that is the formula of opacity. It's non-acknowledgement, even though everybody else knows that Israel has the bomb, and in the language of my title, this is the worst-kept secret.
I want to thank Dr. Avner Cohen for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The book, as he said, is called The Worst Kept Secret, Israel's Bargain with the Bomb. It's an interesting, thoughtful approach to the whole question of nuclear weaponry for Israel. And thank you for a great visit.
It has been a pleasure. Thank you very much, Rabbi Cohen.
My pleasure. And, you know, it's nice to talk to a MacArthur Genius Grant recipient. It makes me feel smarter.
Well, I got
you know.
Two grants. For a year, I'm not the so-called the genius recipient. With all due respect, I got it twice, a smaller grant from the MacArthur Foundation, but not that one.
Does that make you a smaller genius?
I don't know. That makes me maybe just Avner.
Thank you, Avner. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Cohan. Next week, our guest will be Gil Marks, author of a James Beard Award-winning cookbook and a social worker and historian and general Jewish Renaissance man. Our playout this morning comes from Israeli-American Spaniard David Broza and his lovely song, Sigaliot. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
היא התחתנה והיא מאושרת למרות שבעלה היה מנשת ופרד כל הזמן מצוברח קבוע והוא אפילו לא אומר מדוע שלוש שנים שהיא מקבלת מגבר זר תחת דלת מכתבי שירה אליה הם מאירים את אלומיה
מי זה כותב לך ילדונת גלי מי שולח זר פרחים סגול כשהאביב פורח מי בתשי בכל נובמבר בלי ברכה בלי שמורנת.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.